Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a book that analyzes the works of Toni Morrison. Then, Dave Eggers' novel about an introspective dog has been adapted into a play for kids, and a jazz vocalist who leads her own indigenous big band. And guess what? They're coming to Berkeley this week. Today's show is about engaging works that educate and entertain us. And we're celebrating Women's History Month. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, right here on KALW 91.7 FM. Reading a Toni Morrison novel is an experience. Her stories challenge you, shake things up inside, make you question if you're interpreting her messages correctly. At least that's been my experience. Harvard English professor Namwali Sirpal breaks down much of the late author's work in her book on Morrison. It also explores Toni Morrison's politics, thoughts on race, her experiences with the media, and so much more. Professor Sirpal will be in conversation with poet Kathy Park Hong at Hive in Oakland on Thursday, March 12th. Here's our chat about on Morrison. Professor Namwali Sirpal, welcome.
Thank you so much, Janae Darden.
When I heard about this book, I said, I got to talk to her. I said, I got to talk to Professor Sirpal about this.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Take us back to the first Toni Morrison novel you read. What was your impression of her work?
So I first encountered Toni Morrison's work in my sister's dorm room. She was in college. I was in high school. And there was this paperback of Beloved. And it's that old one that has just the hat and the dress, but you can't see a face. Do you remember that
one? Uh-huh, yes.
And I was very drawn to that cover and to the title. And I opened it up. And I read maybe a paragraph, and I was like, I have no idea what's going on. So I closed it, and I put it back on her bookshelf. And, you know, cut to a few years later, I'm in college, and I'm being taught the book in an African-American studies class. And it's a very different experience. I have a professor walking me through the significance of the book, just giving me a sense of the story that's taking place, the different genres that are playing in. And I remember writing a paper about the novel for that class. And so it was almost immediately this exercise in opening up and clarifying everything that had puzzled me or baffled me in the first place. And so my introduction to her work was, this is really complex, difficult literature. And it felt like a challenge. You know, could I actually learn how to read the work of a genius?
Yeah, exact same thing happened to me. I cracked open Beloved, and I didn't get it, and I was like, "She's too hard for me." And so I took a class on race, memory, and motherhood in college, and that's where I had to be taught how to read Toni Morrison. And so once I was taught. And then, too, I was able to infuse my own opinion, of course. Then I was like, oh, okay, now I get her. And you never met her, and you tried not to meet her. I mean, you're an esteemed literature professor, so I know you know people that know her.
I do. And right. Every time I tell people that I was working on this book, or even when I was teaching the class or going to the archives, I would talk to people and they would immediately have a story about when they met her and what it was like. And what's amazing to me is the range of stories. The stories are all so different. A friend of mine who is an editor in England told me that she met her and she noticed that she had like Louboutins on. And she was like, I love your shoes, Ms. Morrison. And Morrison was like, oh yes, Christian makes me special pairs. You know? So her love of fashion came through in that anecdote. But I have other anecdotes about back and forth letters that she would write with colleagues of mine, arguing over a single point. You know, it's like she lived a very various life. And she was a really, she lived a big life. You know, there's this one point where she says, life has to be a gallant affair. And I really feel that when I hear these stories. But I was daunted You know, I could have stood in a signing line after an event that I saw her speak at. And I was like, I don't know about meeting this hero. I don't
Yeah.
know about this, you
Some people don't. They don't want to meet their hero. They don't want to
know?
get disappointed when they meet their heroes. And
Exactly.
was that when you were teaching in the Bay Area? Because you mentioned a
Yes.
story when you were teaching at UC Berkeley and you took your students to an event she
Exactly.
did in San Francisco.
Yes, exactly. At City Arts and Lectures, and it was around 2008. And yeah, and by the time I got out into the lobby for this, you know, to join the signing queue, it was snaking around the building practically. And I was like, I could wait and like have my 5 seconds of, I love you. But I was like, she hears that a million times a day. So I was like, you know what? I think it's okay if I preserve my relationship with her that's just about being a reader and a writer. And it's precious to me in that way.
You open the book with a chapter, and I know everybody been asking you about this. And I thought, I'm gonna be honest with you. I thought this was a bold move. You
Thank
open
you.
the book with a chapter titled "On Difficulty," and I could talk to you about this for the whole my show's an hour. If I could talk to you about the whole hour on this. And you know, Toni Morrison was called difficult. Let me read this little paragraph.
Yeah, sure.
And you write, Morrison has shaped the way we think about everything from literature to politics to criticism to ethics to the responsibilities of making art. But the facts remain, she is difficult to read. She is difficult to teach, notwithstanding the
Voluminous.
thank you, voluminous, that's why you're the professor. Notwithstanding the voluminous train of profiles, reviews, and scholarly analysis that she drags behind her, she is difficult to write about. More to the point, she is our only truly canonical Black female writer, and her work is highly complex. This, it seems, is difficult to swallow. Calling a woman, a Black woman, difficult.
I know.
That's why I said that's a bold move. Why did you want to address that? That she's been called difficult as a person, as a writer? Yeah.
It's a theme that just kept coming up in profiles of her, in interviews with her, in, you know, reviews of her work. And I just found it really interesting that what I saw as an ethos of being difficult had been turned into a personal flaw. It's the way that the righteousness of Black women politically gets read as angry Black woman. You know, it's a
Right.
similar sort of thing where it's like if you insist that people pay attention to what you're saying and that they take the time to understand you, then that is somehow to be a difficult person. And so I kept seeing this tick in the interviews of her, for example, profiles, where somebody would say, I find it really difficult to read your books because I don't understand the Black experience. And she'll say something like, oh, you must have had a hell of a time with Beowulf then, right? And
Right.
I love that because I'm like, she's saying to you, what you're reading as like, I just don't know what it's like to be a Black person, is like, yes, that is a cultural difference that you are willing to bridge when it comes to Old English, you know, an Old English epic poem about knights and dragons. And why would you not feel the same effort to try to bridge that with me? But what I find even more interesting is when she tells this little story to an interviewer, that interviewer says she is clearly not interested in comforting people who find her work difficult. And then they quote her saying, I find myself being more and more difficult these days. I've come to relish it. And I thought, whoa, this is fascinating.
I thought so too when I read that in your book, yeah.
And then I found other moments where she was doing a similar thing. She was making a similar move. And I found one in particular in the archives. It's a draft of a talk that, or a kind of opening speech that she gave to commemorate the launching of a Center for Music that was being dedicated to the Black pianist and composer Mary Lou Williams. And Morrison didn't know her. She never met her. But she asked people about her. She said, what was she like? And she said, and people would say she was difficult. And Morrison said, well, like in person or her work? And people were like, oh, all of it. And she said, and it pleased me to hear that because it meant that she had insisted on being taken seriously. And that again really felt to me like a powerful reclaiming of this word that gets thrown at us and a way of transforming it actually into, again, an ethos.
Yes. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with Harvard English professor and author Namwali Sirpal. Her book on Morrison explores Toni Morrison's work, politics, her thoughts on race, media presence, and so much more. Namwali will be in conversation with poet Kathy Park Hong at Hive in Oakland on Thursday, March 12th. And this is part of a series of readings that the Bay Area Book Festival hosts throughout the year. I want to, while we have several more minutes left, and I do want to talk about the literary analysis that you have in this book. So you analyze just about, all her novels and her works. And I think it's a great companion piece to read after you dig into a Toni Morrison novel or an essay. And I wanted to give an example. Let's take Beloved. So her 1987 Pulitzer Prize winning book, and it's about an enslaved woman who killed her children so they wouldn't experience the horrors of slavery. But the ghost of her daughter haunts her as she's living a free woman, the mother living a free woman. And you mentioned the term gothic as it relates to Beloved. So what does that mean, the gothic?
So the gothic is an old genre of literature, architecture, and art, and it's has a very strong correlation with what we now just call horror stories or ghost stories or terror stories. Some of the novels that we associate with that genre in the British tradition are works like Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre or Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, which just got made into a movie. And in the American tradition, some of the short stories that we associate with Halloween by Edgar Allan Poe, for example, are also considered the Gothic. When you move into the 20th century, you start to get writers like William Faulkner who are writing what's called Southern Gothic, right? Where it's haunted houses, but specifically in the South. And I think Morrison is really riffing on this genre when she's thinking about this ghost story, this American ghost story that she's creating. But she's also very influenced by the way people talked about ghosts, just like in her family and in the community. She sees the belief that there are ghosts, that there are spectral beings, as just a fundamental kind of daily activity in Black life. And so she's trying to interweave that long literary history with her own experience growing up in Lorain, Ohio, with parents who had come from the South. And she also, I think, incorporates elements of what I would call African ghost stories, what she sees as the cultural retentions, the things we kept, even as we cross the Middle Passage, the way we tell a ghost story, the way that we think about a human being as being possibly two human beings, right? All of these different elements of religion and philosophy and spirituality that came with us from across the Atlantic Ocean. So she's combining those three different versions, I think, of what we just now think of as a ghost story.
I think one of the reasons why I struggled when I was younger to read her writing is because I was never taught that she uses a lot of surrealism. You call it, or enchantment, right? Like
That's her word, yeah.
sometimes surrealism and fantasy aren't looked at as like real genres, but that's what she did.
She was playing with all kinds of genre fiction. So I think what I would say is that she's really interested in like the border between the real and the unreal, or the real and the imaginary, memory, the way that memory itself in Beloved, memory itself has a physical presence, right? And this is a really remarkable way of conceptualizing what it's like to live with the afterlife, live in the aftermath of slavery. So I think one of the reasons that I felt like this book would be helpful for people, and that is my great hope, is that it will send people back to read the novels and then to read what I have to say about what Morrison was trying to do, is that you have to understand all of these different contexts that she is drawing from, all these different cultural histories that she's drawing from, in order to really understand what she's doing in the book. And so, yeah, my hope is that by giving that context, that guidance, more people can find their way in so that they can experience the richness of her work.
Again, Toni Morrison was such an accomplished writer. She had the writing career that people dream of. Mm. You know, she won the Nobel Prize. Her work is taught at universities. Mm. But you write about her being misread and underread. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm looking at your book on Morrison. As more books like yours come out into the world, how do you think that may change her being misread and underread?
Thank you for that question. On Morrison sounds like it's going to be a biography. But actually, as you read, you realize I'm actually much more interested in the writing itself. It wasn't just that her themes were interesting or that she was giving us a voice that we'd never heard before. It's that she was taking the novel form and remaking it in so many different and interesting ways. So as you know, as you said earlier, this book will hopefully get people to read and reread her works. That's my highest aim, is just for us to think about her art and not just worship at the altar of her as an artist.
This has been just an honor to talk to you because I love Toni Morrison. And so I just really appreciate just all the scholarly research and information that you put into this book. So Professor Namwali Sirpal, thank you.
Thank you. This was lovely to talk to you. It's always nice to talk to a fellow Morrison head.
Yes. That was Harvard English professor Namwali Sirpal. Her book on Morrison is out now, and make sure to check her out at her author talk at Hive in Oakland on Thursday, March 12th, and tickets are on sale now. Coming up, a Dave Eggers novel that has been adapted into a stage play for kids, and you know what? Adults like me like this story too. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darton, right here on KALW 91.7 FM. As humans, we're often observing animals. But did you ever think that animals may be watching and judging us too? What do animals think about us, and how do they see the world? The novel The Eyes and the Impossible by Dave Eggers is written in the voice of a free dog who lives in an urban park that is very similar to Golden Gate Park. His friends are birds, bison, and a squirrel. His role in the park is to keep an eye on things and make sure humans aren't affecting the park's equilibrium. It's a story for youth and adults, and it's been adapted into a play that's currently running at Z-Space in San Francisco. Delia McDougall is the director, and Nick Moore plays the dog, Johannes. And they're joining me to talk about this great story that I am hooked on. Hello, Delia and Nick.
Hi. Hello.
I love this story. I'm not finished reading it, but I was reading some of it. I was reading some bits online. And then, because I was trying to check it out on Libby, but everybody had checked it out on Libby. Yeah. And so I read the sample. And then I got into it, and then I was able to get a little audio version of it, and then I got hooked, and I said, I got to check this out. So from the library, it's such a good story, and I think it's great that you all have adapted it into a play. But before we even dig into the play, Delia, I want to start with you. This is being put out by Word Play, which is a program. Tell us about Word for Word Play.
Well, I've been working with the company Word for Word now for 30 years and in San Francisco, out of San Francisco. And mostly what Word for Word does is we take short stories and we put them up as a theatrical presentation without changing a single word that the author wrote. So it's this hybrid between writing and performing, because we actually, what we all love so much about books often is the way the writer presented it. And so we have been working for a while, and finally with Gendel Hing Hernandez, we've launched our first production specifically aimed at families and kids. Mm-hmm. And so Word for Word Play is offering for younger kids and their families. And so we just love Dave Eggers as a writer, and he is such a he loves children's writing. I mean, he's worked as a tutor and helps children with their writing. And so we thought Gendel had brought this story to us, and we read it, and we just read the first few pages and just thought it was so joyful and infectious. And it was about community, and it was about seeing from a different perspective. And so we just fell in love with it. And so we don't change a single word of Dave Eggers' lines. We just sort of distribute the lines sometimes among the other animal characters that are in the story. Okay. And then, you know, and then present it.
What is the challenge of doing that? Because I imagine you're not really, changing. You say you're not changing the words at all from the book. How challenging is that? Because I'm thinking that when I watch films that are based on or inspired by books, and we see how much they change. And then, of course, too, other like stage productions. Is that a challenge to really to do that? And like, this is all you have. You have just these words from the page. That's it.
Yeah, it is. It is a challenge, and it's a fun challenge. So Johannes will discuss his puppy siblings, and he says Joni and Janie and Steven and I, and he tells the story about Joni and Janie and Steven, but we'll create Joni and Janie and Steven. And so Joni will say Joni, and Janie will say Janie, and Steven will say Steven and I, and then we just split a sentence apart among those who possibly have, you know, are who he's talking about.
Okay, got it.
But yeah, it's true.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's kind of like a fun juggling of language, and then they act it out, and then it's even grander.
Nice. And this is the first adaption or first play for a word-for-word play. For the kids one. This is the first adaption. Mm-hmm. Okay, this novel is. And this novel, too, won a 2024 Newbery Award. And you're only adapting the first six chapters.
Yes, because it's a very long book.
Yes, it is a very long book.
the first few chapters, when we read it, it seemed like a love poem to Golden Gate Park. And it sort of sets out the novel. And so we thought that would be a good place to introduce, to stop, so that kids and their families could continue the novel if they were interested.
And Nick, you play the main character, the narrator, Johannes, and he's a dog who lives in the hollows of a tree, and he loves to eat pupusas. He's the eyes of the park. Again, that's similar, because Dave Eggers never really says Golden Gate Park, but we know it's Golden Gate Park. tell us about this character and how you portray him, because you are playing a dog. So I'm thinking just like physically the things you have to do.
There's a lot of interesting and unique challenges in the role. From a physical perspective, I mean, it's just a different physicality. And we talked a long time, me and Delia, but also with Gendel, who's running Word for Word Play and also serves as our movement director, about, you know, how much am I embodying a dog? You know, when I came out to audition for this, as I was walking into the audition room, a friend of mine was walking out, and she turns to me and says, "Don't worry, Nick. You don't need to get on all fours."
Oh, okay.
And so I'm not on all fours, crawling on the ground all the time. So we're trying to find a happy medium between the human physicality and the dog physicality, which means a lot of squatting. My thighs are very angry at me after these shows. It means a lot of hunching, a lot of leading with my nose, and all that stuff. And that came from a lot of watching of dogs. We had a whole day of rehearsal where we were just looking at videos of animals and seeing how they move. And then there's the personality of Johannes, which is sort of a mix between a curious child who is figuring out the strange and beautiful and interesting rituals of the world, especially when it comes to humans, who are so difficult to understand from a dog's perspective. And then there's this beautiful artist inside of him.
Yeah.
You know, it's seeing roller skaters and calling them sublime because they're doing something that is strange, confusing, impossible, but also beautiful. Looking at paintings and being and thinking, these are they're so strange. They're like the world in a storm or the world but exploded, you know? And so that mix, which I found as a human, has made me walk around the world looking at it with that curious, introspective, but also artistic eye.
Yeah, he's a beautiful character. He's so funny because he exaggerates. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, I can run as fast as light, and I'm like, Johannes, no, you cannot.
But that's the kid in him, right?
That's the kid in him.
That's the little kid who says, like, I'm the fastest kid in my school. I can run around the blacktop in 1 second. And the blacktop is 1,000 miles long.
Right. You know? Yeah, it is. Yeah. Or like when I think the bison, he was like, yeah, they're like 2 million years old or something like that. He exaggerates.
They've rolled apart for millions of years.
Right. Because, you know, kids always think somebody's older is just super old. But he's a beautiful character. That's why I was like, I have to check out this book from the library. So self-reflective. He's smart too. Yeah, he's smart. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's intelligent, like in this introspective way of, you know, there's a little speech where I talk about being able to pick up on things and ascertain things. And I'm able to, you know, see a ritual happening in the world. Like one of the ones that comes up early in the story and in our version of, in our play, what comes up is seeing these rectangles full of nonsense. And those are paintings, right? And being able to pick up on, okay, the rectangles are there. Someone made them. Other people are walking by them. That must be the point of this, to make a rectangle that people can walk by. And I think that's it's beautiful because it makes us look back on our rituals and think, how did we figure this all out when we were kids?
Yeah, and the language in the book is beautiful too. That's why I say it's appealing to children and adults, because I really fell in love with the language. Delia, how was Dave Eggers involved in this project, or at all? Like, did he just say, hey, here's a book, run with it? Or did he help?
He said, go ahead. And when we first put it up as a reading, he showed up and saw some of it, but he had to go. He has just been very generous. And Nick, I think he showed up to a school thing that you guys did too, right?
Yeah.
Did an event at the San Francisco Public Library. And he came for the event and did a Q&A with the kids afterwards.
Yeah,
go ahead, Delia. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's just very gracious with his time, especially if he can affect kids and their interests in writing and reading.
Yeah. Nick, did you have any jitters, especially when he showed up?
I think there was this thought in me, because this, I mean, Dave Eggers is someone who I've heard about, known about, whose books I've read for a long time, you know?
Yeah.
And so when we all heard he was coming to the library event, I think we all had this little, you know, this nervousness, like we're putting his words on stage word for word, and he's going to see it for the first time. And he is the most, like, so friendly, so sweet and so loving, that it's instantly like all those jitters, all the nerves went away the moment he shook my hand. It was like, oh no, he loves writing, he loves supporting the arts, supporting especially children making arts. I mean, his libraries that he's set up on Valencia is for young authors to empower them to write their own books and put their own stories into the world. And, you know, that he just exudes that kind of love, which is wonderful.
If you're just tuning in, we're chatting about the play adaptation of Dave Eggers' award-winning novel, The Eyes and the Impossible. It's about a dog and his animal friends who live free in a park that's very similar to Golden Gate Park. But humans are being human, unfortunately, and affecting their habitat. Delia McDougall is the play's director. Nick Moore plays the dog's Johannes. And you can see this family show at Z-Space in San Francisco until March 15th. And I also recommend reading the book as well. You know, what I like about this story, again, is that it appeals to adults and to children. And there are so many themes. And, you know, one of them is family and friendship. Johannes is living an undomesticated life, unlike his mother and his siblings. He's free. And his family aren't other dogs, but they're birds and bison and squirrels. And I just learned so much. And, you know, Delia, you mentioned community. And I'm just thinking, like, you know, how do we learn about friendship, family, and community in this story?
Yeah, it's. I love that it starts out with a sort of joyful and infectious exultation of freedom from this dog who sort of starts telling us about his growing up in, inside of this park. And then he meets the bison, and they use his talents as his enthusiasm and his running. And they sort of direct him to a purpose, which really shifts something in him. And then he becomes the eyes of the park and the community. And he has assistants, other animals in the park that also are part of the eyes. And together they protect the animals. And as the bison say, they help maintain the equilibrium between humans in the park and the animals of the park. And I think, you know, what Dave Eggers wrote, that Johannes says later in the novel, he says, if there are troubles in your mind, you should think first of others. It is the essence of liberation.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So it's like he really understands that freedom, and not just freedom from something, but freedom to affect the world, to change the world by coming together in community and making a bigger impact.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so lovely about this story.
I'm like, I want that dog, but I know he want to be free.
Right.
I can't have him because he wants to be free. Nick, what are some themes that stood out for you, or if you want to piggyback on what Delia just said?
Yeah, I found something really beautiful was that exaltation on freedom, was that exploration of freedom, because freedom is not, you know, we think of freedom as one of those virtues that we put on a pillar, and that is so great, and we always want to strive for it. But there's also these parts of the story that we're going into also go into some of the costs of freedom.
Right.
I mean, at the beginning of the story, my family leaves me. Right? They all get taken by humans and are kept dogs. And while I laugh at them being pets and that they get to have to be fed from a kibble bag and all that, they're also fed daily. They don't have to scrounge for their food. They don't have to fend for their food. They're in happy homes. They're with each other. They get a certain level of comfort and safety that comes with being not free. And I think there's many points in which Johannes is choosing between the safety of, you know, staying in a box and the freedom that comes from leaving that box.
Right.
And in the end, always chooses freedom, of course, because I'm a free dog who's fast and free, right? But also still grapples with some of the difficulty that comes that comes from choosing to be free in a world where safety comes often in boxes.
Yeah. And then too, it makes you, you know, look at or remind you that, you know, we share the planet. We share the environment with the, you know, with animals. And then too, you see the animal in humans when humans are disrespecting the park or disrespecting other animals, you know. And it's funny because they're looking at us as animals. Like the dogs, you know, Johannes is observing us like we observe animals. So it kind of reminds you that, oh, you know, there's animal and humans too as well. Yeah, which I thought was interesting. What has been the kids' reactions to the play so far?
The kids have been absolutely wonderful to have in the audience. So we have this special seating arrangement where there are two rows of kids who get to sit on the floor on little flower pillows right up against the stage. And so they're a little bit in that stage light. So I get to see those kids, their eyes right there. And kids are such a unique and wonderful audience, since they give you so much energy back. They haven't learned yet that they're supposed to sit quietly and not interrupt or distract the actors. They're happy to shoot me a thumbs up, to wave at me. I had a kid when I said this park is 10,000 miles along its length. One kid shouted, "No, it's not." when I say, "Have you seen the movement of light?" I had a chorus of kids say, "Yeah." And luckily my next line is, "You have not seen the movement of light," so I could respond to them. But you know, the kids are they're wonderful to have around, and if you can hold the attention of kids around 8 to 10 for about an hour and a half, I think we've been very successful, and so that's a big feat on its own.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very big feat on its own. And that speaks to you as an mm-hmm. artist. We have to go, but I really enjoy speaking with both of you. And thank you for bringing this work on stage and inspiring kids to read it and check it out and analyze theater. It's good, you know, getting the kids in theater early, right? So, Delia and Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with director Delia McDougall and actor Nick Moore. See their play, The Eyes and the Impossible, at Z-Space in San Francisco until March 15th. And next up, an Indigenous and Native American jazz band is coming to perform at Berkeley, and they're going to give the audience a history lesson, too. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. Hey, when it comes to jazz, Native American artists are underrepresented, and their historical contributions to the genre are often overlooked. Julia Keefe is a Native American jazz singer and educator who is trying to change that. She's opened for the likes of Tony Bennett and Esperanza Spalding, and she leads the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band. The jazz ensemble is made up of Indigenous and Native American musicians, and that music you heard earlier is from their new album. They'll be performing at Zellerbach Playhouse in Berkeley this Friday, March 6th. Julia Keefe entertains during her shows and educates her audiences on jazz and Native American history. She is an enrolled member of the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho, and she's now based in New York City. Here's our conversation. Julia Keefe, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, your story is amazing, and the music you make is just really, really beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Tell us briefly, what about jazz caught your ear?
Jazz, I mean, my earliest musical memory was listening to Billie Holiday. I had to have been maybe 4 years old, and I just have this memory of my mom tidying up the living room, and we were listening to Billie Holiday's greatest hits from the Decca label. And I remember the CD case, it was like this periwinkle sort of cloth fabric CD case, and the song No More was forever etched into my subconscious from the time that I was four. And so I think jazz has always been part of my ear and part of my sort of DNA, my chemical makeup. And so it really is the only like natural progression I felt when I started studying music in junior high and high school, that, you know, jazz would be the genre that really spoke to me and I got the privilege to pursue.
Yeah. And you were growing up in Idaho and you're from the Nez Perce tribe,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yep.
A shout out to the tribe.
Yeah, shout out to the Nez Perce tribe. Yeah, I grew up in Kamiai, Idaho on my tribe's reservation. And I was singing in the church mainly. That was sort of my earliest music education was in the church. And then, you know, as we get older, you get into fifth grade and you have to pick up an instrument to play in bands. I picked up the clarinet, and that was the first time I heard about Benny Goodman, who's a famous clarinetist and big band leader. But then around that time, my family moved from Kamiai, Idaho to Spokane, Washington to be closer to hospitals because my tribe is really rural and that town, Kamiai, Idaho, is very, very rural. So we moved to Spokane. And when I enrolled in school up there, that was when I got into choir and that formal music education as a vocalist began.
Tell us, who is Mildred Bailey? And what does Mildred Bailey mean to you?
Oh, gosh. Mildred Bailey has been my North Star since I first stumbled across her name. When I was in high school, I was going to the high school that Bing Crosby went to. And being the young jazz nerd that I was just voracious for information about Bing Crosby's time in the Inland Northwest. And I was reading his autobiography, Call Me Lucky, and I stumbled across this name, Mildred Bailey. And Bing Crosby said, I was very fortunate to have known the great jazz vocalist, Mildred Bailey, early in life. And I had never heard her name before. I'd never seen her name before, at least that I could remember. And I started just doing a little bit of research on her. And she was one of the first female vocalists to front a big band. She was the full-time vocalist for the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And she was a member of the Coeur d'Alene tribe, which is from around that same area, not too far from Spokane and the Spokane Reservation. The tribe next door to the east is the Coeur d'Alene tribe. And as a young jazz musician, that was the first time I saw myself reflected in this music that I really, really love. Mildred Bailey also gave me permission to sort of exist on the bandstand. So when I was gigging as like a 14 and 15 year old in Spokane, when I would introduce myself as a Native American jazz singer, sometimes I was met with this almost like confrontation from audience members. Like, what do you mean by that? What do you mean you're a Native American jazz singer? And because people have this idea of what it is to be Native American and a Native American musician and what it is to be a jazz musician. And these two things couldn't be married in the consciousness of these audience members. So I started to not really introduce myself as Native American jazz singer. I was just jazz singer Julia Keefe for a while. And then by being able to point to this historical figure who rose to prominence in the 30s and 40s, who was also a Native American jazz singer, I could point to her and say, see, I can be here because she was here. And it gave me something to talk about. And so by providing that historical context, I don't know, it kind of softened people's opinions and perspectives of me and my right to be on the bandstand and exist within that space. But Mildred Bailey recorded hundreds of amazing records. She hosted her own radio program. She was a huge advocate for integrated bands and sang at integrated clubs, but she died in obscurity in 1951 because she was a larger woman who suffered from diabetes and actually succumbed to diabetes complications in 1951. She was also a huge outspoken advocate for herself and her music and her artistry. And you know, a lot of these downbeat magazines from the time would say, oh, Mildred Bailey needs to stay in her place. You know, Red Norvo, her husband, needs to control his woman sort of language, because she would push back if people tried to tell her how to be an artist. And that was a problem. And I think, you know, the music scene, while I think in a lot of ways it has improved, in some ways it's exactly the same. And so reading about her story, again, I saw myself reflected as a woman in jazz, having to confront a lot of those biases and stereotypes about being a female vocalist and having a say in how your music turns out in the end.
And you're not only a female vocalist, but you have your own big band. And I can't remember the last time I've seen a woman lead their own big jazz band. When did you launch the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band?
I launched the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band in 2022. I had applied for a grant to put together this big band. So I connected with my dear friend and co-founder of the band, Delbert Anderson, who is Diné Navajo trumpeter out of Farmington, New Mexico. And the first time we met, like a half hour conversation turned into a 3 hour conversation. And we were just talking about jazz and jazz history in tribal nations and on tribal lands, as well as indigenous people who rose to prominence, including Mildred Bailey, including Keeley Smith, Oscar Pettiford, Big Chief Russell Moore, Jim Pepper. So we were just really geeking out together and sort of offhandedly brought up, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we had an all-Native big band? Oh, yeah, that would be so cool. Be sure to hire me when you start it. No, you be sure to hire me. And then it was kind of put to bed. It was put up on the shelf and we didn't really touch it again until this grant opportunity came up. And Delbert actually called me and said, hey, I think you should submit for this grant. I think you should submit for the Indigenous Big Band. I think you're the person to do it. And, you know, I think this is a really great opportunity for us to be up on the bandstand in a large ensemble setting. And so, you know, with Delbert's blessing, I put together this huge proposal and we were awarded full funding, which was awesome. And then, of course, came the immense task of finding, you know, 16 Indigenous jazz musicians. I mean, at that point, I had only known of Delbert and myself and our friend Molly Obomsawin, who plays bass in the band. I was like, oh my God, oh, what is this like huge legal obligation that I just put myself in to put this together? But did a big call for artists and the response was overwhelming. And we had our very first performance in May of 22 at the Washington Center for Performing Arts in Olympia, Washington. And I commissioned new work. I paid for some of the band members' original compositions to be arranged. You know, it was a big administrative undertaking to put this together, but we had our own book of music that was just ours. And it was such a beautiful experience. And the guys in the band, the folks in the band were like, so we're going to keep doing this, right? Like, this was awesome. We should keep doing this, right? I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with jazz singer Julia Keefe. She leads the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band, and the ensemble celebrates Indigenous and Native jazz musicians and their work. Watch them perform at Zellerbach Playhouse in Berkeley this Friday, March 6th. Okay, so you have a new album that's coming out. It's called Incarnadine, and the lead single is Wawasintonda. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
It got a rhythm to it. It got a rhythm to it. Those beautiful Indigenous languages have rhythms to it.
Yes.
So let's take a listen to the lead single, Wawasintonda. No. Okay, so Julia, we just heard your lead single from your new album. So tell us about this song, Wawasintonda, and tell us what does that word mean? And because your songs have, it's y'all not just jamming.
Mm-hmm.
Y'all jamming with a purpose. There's some history in the way y'all jamming. And like, I love how some of your music, you infuse like just, you know, different Indigenous sounds. So tell us what this is about.
Yes. So this piece actually was brought to me by Molly Obomsawin, the bassist for the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band. She's a Abenaki of Odinak First Nation tribal member and a really beautiful composer and singer in her own right. And this song, Wawasintonda, translates to religious song. It was actually a Catholic hymn that was translated into the Abenaki language by one of the early French Jesuit missionaries who encountered the Abenaki people. And so what Molly did with this song in her first album called Sweet Tooth, and what we, you know, later sort of expanded upon for the big band, she really meditates on the insidiousness of indoctrination by way of, you know, spiritual exercise, right? I mean, the paradox of this song is that, you know, it was translated into Abenaki in order to convert Indigenous peoples into Christianity, but it was also a lot of these tunes were language preservation tools later on. Like the fact that we have these songs, even in my tribe, there's a whole hymn book that has been translated into my tribe's language, and it is part of our curriculum for language preservation and revitalization. But what Molly did so beautifully was, you know, we start out in this very traditional musical style, very chorale, very Western European sound with the Abenaki language sort of soaring on top of it. And then as the song progresses, it starts to deconstruct and fall apart and get out and weird and free and complicated. And I think that's, it really is emblematic of Indigenous people's relationship with Christianity. In a lot of ways, it became a central focal point for a lot of our communities, but in a lot of ways, it also disintegrated part of our cultural identity and that connection to land and stewardship and each other. So it really is this beautiful, complex arrangement that I think the band plays so beautifully, but it's one of my favorite songs to play because of just how complex the subject matter is.
And will you be performing this as Zellerbach at UC Berkeley?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Right. We kind of put together our set list, like, you know, during our sound check. I would love to. I think so. I think that would be great. It's such a beautiful tune. I would love to perform this.
Julia, I wish I could talk to you longer because there's so much history. And I just appreciate, too, that when you perform, you also teach. And I know, too, you're an educator as well. So for people coming to the concert, you're not just going to hear great music. Julia also, too, is going to, she's going to teach you. She's going to school you and just give you the historical context of this beautiful music, of this beautiful history, this complex history. So I just appreciate you for what you're doing. And yeah, and just for giving this, putting this gift out into the world. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's given my life and artistry purpose to lead this band and help build this community. So thank you so much for giving us a space to talk about it.
That was jazz vocalist Julia Keefe. The Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band is performing at Zellerbach Playhouse in Berkeley this Friday, March 6th. And look out for their new album, Incarnadine, in May. That's all the time we have for the show today. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, engineer Devin Strolovich, and our board operator, Damian Miner. And thank you for tuning in. Just a reminder, if you have an EBT card, you can get deep discounts and even free admission to some museums and other arts and entertainment spaces. Make sure you tell folks who don't know about that. This month is our show's 1-year anniversary, and we're going to have a special episode in a couple of weeks to celebrate. And we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.